Kia ora, welcome to episode 61 of the SWNZ podcast, the podcast for New Zealand Star Wars fans. My name is Matt.
And my name is Christy.
Another interesting week for news from a galaxy far, far away, so let's jump in and talk Star Wars. Starting with our news roundup and product announcements. First on our list to discuss this week is that the Armageddon Expo Tauranga has been officially postponed. Previously set to take place on the 26th to 27th of February, new dates for this Tauranga event are July the 23rd to 24th of this year. Regarding other upcoming Armageddon Expos, including Christchurch, which is the next one currently scheduled for 26th and 27th of March, the organisers of Armageddon Expo say, currently we are holding on to the dates for Christchurch and Wellington as the next events. However, we have reserved backup dates later in the year, as it's highly likely that we will have to postpone these events as well. So this means we are still looking at having a total of 6 Armageddon Expos in New Zealand over the coming year, but they are going to be all crammed pretty much into the second half of the year.
It must be hard for the organisers, because I know a certain component of Armageddon Expos for both the organisers and fans is getting celebrity guests either through virtual Zoom call appearances or in person, and constantly having to juggle dates and shift them around is a little bit hard. You want to be able to sort of lock in talent. People want to lock in travel plans and things like that, but obviously we need to be able to do these in a safe setting. Obviously with the thousands of people that turn up to Armageddons, it's not quite possible to do that under red. So fingers crossed things will improve, because we're certainly looking forward to the Armageddon events this year, wherever they happen to take place first. Whichever is the first event to be held in New Zealand will be the sort of the big 100th sort of celebration of Armageddon, which was due to be Auckland last year, but that was postponed. So it'll be interesting to see which one actually gets that designation.
Yeah, at this rate, it may end up being the midwinter Auckland Armageddon. At the time that Tauranga Armageddon was announced, and as we're building up to that previous date, there were no Star Wars guests announced to my knowledge. But there's, as we say, we're looking forward to many Armageddon Expo events through the year, so we're really keeping our fingers crossed for some Star Wars guest announcements in some form or another, because there's lots of new and interesting and even New Zealand related Star Wars guests that could theoretically make an appearance, and it would be great to see that additional Star Wars flavour to the Armageddon events for 2022. Other news in our news roundup list, Hasbro expands its relationship with Disney's Lucasfilm, extending the Star Wars license and adding a new deal for the Indiana Jones franchise. Now, I know there are a couple of valid critiques of some of the aspects of Hasbro's Star Wars product lines just at this point in time, including pricing on exclusive and deluxe items that are in part a consequence of some challenges that they and other manufacturers are facing at this point in time. But it is interesting to know that at least Hasbro is going to continue making Star Wars products for the foreseeable future. The timelines for this extended contract have not been revealed. There will be a cap that will be for a block of time, of course, but it will presumably be extended on an ongoing basis. Now, my thoughts on this just personally, I know that there are things that Hasbro could be doing better, but in some ways I would prefer Hasbro to fix things internally and keep being the mainstay for Star Wars product, with other companies producing stuff, different stuff in parallel. Because of course Hasbro has been manufacturing Star Wars since the early 90s with the Power of the Force line, kicking off between 95 and going through to 2000 before it morphed into other lines. And of course they purchased Kenner, who have been producing Star Wars toys since the very beginning. And it's nice to sort of have that longevity and that heritage in some ways, personally, I think, rather than shaking things up and perhaps some other company coming in and doing things in quite a different way, and perhaps even other formats other than the standard 375 and 6-inch.
Yeah, I'm glad that it's continuing on. Obviously, with just about every Star Wars company, there's always things that you wish they did a little bit differently. But on the whole, we've generally been happy with Hasbro. I do wish that they would sort of get away from doing so many exclusives. Yes. I know even in America, Americans complain about Walmart exclusives and Target exclusives, because these big box retailers don't treat them like collectibles. They treat them like toys. So the packaging's often mangled. The pre-orders can get messed up and things like that, because they don't really appreciate how important these things are to arrive in good condition, and how you can't just like go buy a different one. You know, you need a very specific item and things that.
Without a doubt, there's many, many things that could be improved. But as I say, I'd rather that's done internally at Hasbro, because almost with certainty, if someone else took over the lines, their new figures in many ways would not fit in with our existing collections. And that's
that's
fine. They'd be nice collections in their own right. But there's just something to be said for if you've got a big display or collection of 3.75 or Black Series figures, just that sort of continuity of overall style and approach to the figures. And I'd rather see other material done in parallel, not to the full demise of Hasbro in terms of their making Star Wars product.
For the most part, most Star Wars collectibles have been continually made by the original company. Like we see Funko, Hasbro, we've got Sideshow, Gentle Giant, Hot Toys. They started a line and they've continued, and it hasn't really jumped around. We've had new additions, like Funko's more of a modern era addition to the line.
Yeah.
But I like that you can sort of jump into whichever format you like, 12-inch, Funko, Hasbro action figures, and it just kind of continues. They keep adding to it without trying to have like reboot and restart and have like these sort of chunked collections from different manufacturers.
Well, the strong contrast that's in my mind that makes me think along these lines is the way Star Trek figures have been handled. And if you want to collect, if you collect Star Trek figures, they're all quite confined to blocks in time without a lot of relationship or compatibility over time. They've gone through quite a few different manufacturers and quite a few different scale variations and style variations.
When, like you say, Star Trek changing hands and things like that, I think the thing that happens that really exacerbates is you get kind of the reboot and they do like the main characters over and over. So you get like Spock and Captain Kirk and things like that. And then you never really dive into the later ones with all the sort of background characters. And Star Wars is huge for background characters. So we need the sort of longevity to start really getting in like, oh yeah, that random denizen in the back of Jabba's palace, you know, that the average kid or the average sort of basic collector is not going to need for their collection. But us legacy collectors, we need all the fleshed out characters. We don't need yet more Vaders. I mean, we still buy them, but we don't need a Vader for our collection. We've already got a handful of them. So I'm glad. I hope this is like generally when you extend a relationship like this, it's generally for like 5 years, maybe even 10 years. So I'm hoping that this means that, you know, we're in for a good chunk of time in the future. And it does bode well for continuing extensions in the future as well, especially expanding into Indiana Jones.
So, I mean, the main thing we were just talking about there was figures, but the other thing that Hasbro has completely kept knocking out of the park is the Black Series helmets and Force FX lightsabers at this point in time. There's some superb lightsabers coming out, and we'll talk about that shortly. And we just love the Black Series Star Wars 1-to-1 scale helmets that are coming from Hasbro and want to see that continue on an ongoing basis. But just to wrap up the story, that Indiana Jones toy line, slightly off topic but relevant to the overall conversation, from Hasbro will be available from 2023, aligning with the release of the new Indiana Jones feature film starring Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, of course. Moving on to discuss another manufacturer. The first official images for the next wave of LEGO Star Wars helmets for 2022 have been showing up online. Actually, I believe these are initially via a leak from Amazon Poland. They show the Mandalorian helmet and a Luke Skywalker Red 5 X-Wing pilot helmet. 75328 for the Mandalorian set and code number 75327 for Luke Skywalker Red 5. And also new coming out from LEGO, there is a LEGO set 75324, a Dark Trooper Attack, due out next month. This features three Dark Trooper minifigs and a Luke Skywalker as a Jedi Knight in the Mandalorian era. And this is set on a little diorama showing Luke's entrance into the corridor of Moff Gideon's Star Cruiser to face off against the Dark Troopers.
Yeah, these packs are quite cool when they're sort of heavy on the minifigs, you know, so you can army build your Dark Trooper pack out a little bit there, because that was such an iconic scene. I can just imagine, yeah, putting all those figures together to kind of recreate a hallway, and the really clever LEGO builders out there can flesh out the whole corridor and make really quite a nice diorama with the set.
Yeah, and interesting to see more of these LEGO Star Wars helmets. The Mandalorian helmet, of course, is a minor variation on the Boba Fett helmet, which is already out there, but the X-Wing pilot, brand new, doesn't translate quite as well as some of the other ones, to be honest, in my personal opinion. The visor, maybe a little clunky, but nice to have that addition to the set in some ways, I think.
Yeah, because there aren't as many Rebel helmets as there are Imperial helmets. It reminds me a little bit of the recent Batman helmet with the sort of open face. I think it's still fun. I'd like to see what they look like off the display stands. So if you have a personal preference, whether you could just kind of sit it on a shelf without the black stand, so you'd have more of sort of an internal view. But yeah, definitely cool to see this line continuing.
All right, and also in the product announcement sort of conversation zone, J. Just yesterday, a new Black Series Boba Fett figure, a 6-inch scale version of the Tython appearance of Boba Fett. This is following on from the fairly recent, I think we talked about it last week, 3.75-inch TVC version of the Tython Boba Fett, also referred to as Jedi Ruins. It was announced yesterday as part of the Bring Home the Bounty bonus bounty sort of follow-on campaign where they're kind of really just doing one figure per week. It was a Walmart exclusive, but then today it's announced that it's going to be postponed with no confirmed date. Again, as we said last week regarding the 3.75 TVC version of this Tython Boba Fett, we don't know who may carry it in New Zealand, if anyone, but we are keeping our eyes peeled and we'll report that on SWMZ website and social media if we hear or other people give us information that they have seen it locally. Speaking of local store reports, the Seagate Beskar Ingot Firecuda portable game hard drive that we discussed a few podcasts back has been shown up in New Zealand. We reported that it was initially seen in EB Games Australia. We might see it locally. That may yet pan out, but Mighty 8 does have this. The 2 terabyte version is priced at about $150 New Zealand. Product that we've talked about before has been available for pre-order is starting to show up locally. In particular, the Rey Skywalker Force FX lightsaber from Hasbro, available from Mighty 8, EB Games and other retailers, is showing up on the shelves in person at EB Games and in physical stores from EB Games. Priced at $4.99 from Mighty 8 and shipping soon from them, and priced at $5.19 from EB Games. This is one of the best Force FX lightsabers that we've seen so far with some really unique features.
Yes, I was super excited when I saw this revealed on a sort of Hasbro YouTube live stream some while back, and it's really fun that it's hitting shelves. I think the Black Series lightsaber range is really hitting its stride. They've been doing some really interesting designs and adding a lot more features to these lightsabers, well and above the original old school sort of Force FX, even going back to the Master Replicas era. The blades are fully removable. They come with a lot of sort of flash on clash type blade effects all the way down. When you ignite them, the sort of the blade ignites up, yeah, rather than just turning all on.
Yeah, so it's got a full core of LEDs rather, yes, than the sort of old school style of just having lighting in the emitter, which gives you so much control over the effects that you can get out of it. It's also really, really bright. This is a yellow blade, but it's bright even under natural sunlight, isn't it?
Yes. And like the most of the modern Force FX lightsabers, because you can take the blade out, you can put it for display as a hilt on the included display stand. So if you don't want to have a whole lot of really unwieldy long display items, if you don't have the space for it, you can tuck the lightsaber blades away and just display the hilt on a shelf so you can sort of add them all together.
It seems like a small thing, but it's actually a really cool evolution of the product line. I've been doing that for a few releases now, and it means you can put them on a sort of bookshelf height shelf in this vertical format on the stands, and they look really, really cool together if you've got more than one or more than a couple all on the matching stands. Each of their Force FX Elite Series lightsabers with removable blades have matching stands.
A couple of other neat details that I really, really like on this hilt. It has some really good weathering. There is like a rust and sort of worn metal elements to it. The fabric wrap in the middle is real fabric, and the turning on switch is the sort of the circular
switch
component that you slide round to the side. It's not a push button to ignite.
Button,
yeah. They've done it functionally the same way we see Rey ignite her saber in the film, which is a really neat effect. And it's even got the little teeth that fit around the emitter. They can fold up and down depending on whether you have a blade in it or want to sort of display it closed. So many great details on this one. It's definitely worth having a look, especially if you're a lightsaber collector. I know this hilt has been done by some fan lightsaber makers out there, but it's definitely really worth checking out the limited sort of licensed collectible versions, because I think this is one of the best ones they've done.
Side note, it must be almost solid metal based on the weight in terms of the overall chassis and the external detail. It's a really, really, and that translates to a really nice authentic product. Other product that we've talked about previously, but which is now available in stores, the Black Series Gaming Greats Zelbar figure. This is Zelbar the Wookiee from Knights of the Old Republic in the Black Series Gaming Greats line, which is exclusive to EB Games in New Zealand, is showing up in physical stores. It's priced at $59. If you had a pre-order for this, you may have received it or will be receiving it shortly. But if you want to check it out in person, go to your local branch of EB Games. They seem to have a reasonable number per branch.
Saddlebot's a really cool figure, a really cool character from Knights of the Republic. It does make me a little bit curious as to why they decided to kind of do him. We've got Revan, both sort of Darth Revan and a Jedi Knight Revan, obviously referencing the story.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, cool. I'm hoping they do more characters from that iconic video game. But Zalbar is kind of like an odd one to start with. I would have expected something like Bastila Shan, Kath O'Nessi, one of the slightly more prominent characters as a way, and then kind of start alternating between some sort of minor characters. Because I would have expected at least to release Zalbar alongside Mission Veo, because the two of them go together. You can't really sort of have one and not the other. So they haven't confirmed that there are more coming in this line, but I'm really, really hoping so, because I don't think a lot of people want to jump in and get one of this character unless they know there's going to be a whole range of them to sort of put the whole squad together. So fingers crossed Hasbro reveals a few others in this line soon.
Yeah, so we'll keep our eye out for that. They don't tend to release figures from the same game back to back. They do, if they do,
they jump around.
They space them out, which is a curious way to do it. I know that the overall theming of the line is just stuff from video games rather than focusing on a specific video game and filling that out, but it would be nice to see more that kind of go together in a logical way. And again, we seem to be hitting on a lot of product we've talked about before, that which is now currently available. But the Warehouse seems to be the exclusive carrier of a couple of Black Series 6-inch carbonized collection figures. So these are the carbonized versions of figures that have been released in a standard paint format. We're pretty familiar with them by now. But the Paz Vizsla Heavy Mandalorian figure, which comes in a deluxe size box and is priced at $65, is available in pretty good numbers at most branches, and has specific relevance now in the context of the most recent episode of The Book of Boba Fett. Also, we've talked about this carbonized line before. It works so much better for figures that have armor on, because the metalized paint apps make sense on an armored figure. They don't make sense on a figure with cloth apparel or, you know, skin, a lot of skin showing, but they work really well for armored figures like Paz Vizsla the Heavy Mandalorian in particular.
Yeah, the carbonized armorer figure was kind of an odd choice for me, because she's got a leather skirt, a lot of faux fur, or, you know, real fur, in-world faux fur on the figure. And so she's generally got her chest plate and her helmet. The helmet is already a gold, so it's already got a metallic finish to it. So you're basically getting a little bit more shimmer in her chest plate, which seems like, if you're a completionist, that's fun, because she's an important character. But yes, the pastels, I think, works really well.
And the other reason we're bringing up this specific figure at this point in time is just as a reminder that you can buy product from the Warehouse either in-store or via the Warehouse website, but you can also buy it via themarket.com, which is, of course, owned by the Warehouse. And the reason why that's specifically interesting is because they very frequently run unique discounts and campaigns where you can actually knock a few dollars off some of these figures compared to buying it in person or via the warehouse.co.nz website directly. Like for currently, for example, I think there are 5% and 10% off coupons, which this figure actually qualifies for. You can activate those at the time you are putting the product into your cart and use them at the checkout. And if you're part of the Market Club, you also get a discount on an ongoing basis for a lot of product, including Star Wars product.
The Market Club is sort of like Amazon Prime or Primate from Mighty Ape. You sort of pay an ongoing fee and it unlocks certain discounts like exclusive coupons. It also, depending on the tier you have, you can get free shipping. So if I know that the Warehouse and online outlets often put things in assortments, but because Paz Vizsla is a one case assortment, it's just him in the box, he shows up on the website as a very specific figure. So this isn't an assortment. So it'll be up to you whether you decide that joining up and getting the discount for paying a subscription to the Market, whether you do a lot of online shopping. It has a lot of retailers. I know Toyco is a member on there as well, but definitely sometimes it's worth checking out because they do have random sales, which can be as high as 10% or even a little bit higher for even just non-logged in members.
And they don't even necessarily coincide with other toy sales that the Warehouse is running, for instance. So just a tip, if you're not already familiar with it, check out the Market, search for Star Wars product that you've seen at the Warehouse, and you may be able to save a reasonable few dollars on some of these products, and that's worth considering when we're talking about the slightly overpriced figures like the deluxe line.
Especially if you're someone that doesn't live within a close distance from the warehouse, you'll save money driving out to the store to see if they have the figure on the shelf.
All right, let's talk about The Book of Boba Fett, Episode 5, Return of the Mandalorian. Now, it's been pretty cliche almost that everybody online has been saying this looked more like an episode of The Mandalorian than The Book of Boba Fett, because the main character featured is The Mandalorian. We didn't actually see Boba Fett. But either way, I actually quite like this approach to storytelling and overlapping and interweaving of the stories. And let's jump in and break it down. First up, this is directed by Bryce Dallas Howard, who is getting a lot of love and accolades for her work on The Book of Boba Fett and previously Mandalorian. And written by, again, Jon Favreau, who has penned all of the episodes for The Book of Boba Fett so far. Worth noting that Bryce Dallas Howard has done two other episodes of Star Wars live action material for Disney+. Chapter 4, Sanctuary of the Mandalorian, and Chapter 11, The Aerys of the Mandalorian. That latter episode, I think, is quite relevant to discussion of this current episode, because that is the episode where Bo-Katan Kryze shows up, along with Koska Reeves and Axe Woves. And it's the first instance where Din Djarin sees somebody else, another Mandalorian, take off their helmet. So Bryce Dallas Howard is really starting to work with some of that more complex and deeper Mandalorian lore. And there's a really interesting post that she made on social media a while back where she showed one of her sort of mind map notes that she got from Dave Filoni explaining the history and backstory of these key elements of Mandalorian lore. So she's really embracing it and building on it in quite an interesting and complex way. And it's great to see somebody engaging at that level. So in this episode, I mean, the essence of this episode is that the Mandalorian, now without his ship, is trying to get a replacement ship and trying to hook up with any Mandalorians that survived the purge on Navarro. He achieves this, gets information about where they might be hiding by taking on a job to, just a random job, to take down a Clatoonian crime boss of some sort. And in essence, he makes his way to Tatooine, where he interacts again with Pelimoto, which is really fun to see that character. And she has a ship for him, not a Razor Crest per se, but a Naboo N1 Starfighter. Very, very cool to see this prequel era starship in live action again. And, you know, a little bit of montage-y scenes where they repair the N1 and soup it up significantly. And I'm sure that's all going to come into play for the final episodes down the line. So lots and lots of Easter eggs and callbacks in this episode that we're going to break down now.
After the previous episode of The Book of Boba Fett ended with that sort of telltale use of the Mandalorian theme, everyone was like, okay, it's going to be Din Djarin. He's going to show up. He's going to show up. And it was a matter of like, when is he going to show up? How is he going to cross paths with Boba Fett? And this episode just started with like, boom, it's just him straight away. Like no dilly-dallying, just straight into it. He's here. He's doing a bounty. He's getting on with his life, because we don't really know what he's done since we last saw the final episode of The Mandalorian, where there was a kind of the standoff with Moff Gideon and then Luke and all that sort of stuff. So it's interesting. We're finally sort of seeing he's back to bounty hunting.
Yeah.
But he's got a little bit of a sort of a side quest here, because as we find out, he's taken this bounty, which of course we see him execute, because he wants information to track down sort of the bounty hunters that might have
the Mandalorians
that might have survived the sort of the imperial slaughter of his sort of conclave on Navarro. And we see him sort of tracking sort of hidden little Mandalorian symbols down a side street as info given to him by the person he delivers the bounty to. Just as a side note, at the start, I was not sure whether they would bring into how much story elements from The Mandalorian that we would see. But as we see him sort of tussle with some of the people as he's trying to collect the bounty, he pulls out the Darksaber. So like, okay, he's still got it. He's actively using it. It's not just like something that he's kind of keeping hidden. He is pulling it out and using it. So he doesn't seem too afraid of it. He obviously knows the importance, the significance of this weapon within the Mandalorian culture, but he is using it and wielding it. So that was really interesting to see. We see him use it to great effect. He slices somebody in half, and then sort of off camera, we know that he uses the blade to behead his bounty, because he takes the head in a sack to deliver it to get the information that he needs. It's really cool to see that Paz Vizsla and the Armorer, we don't really have a name for her yet, but they have survived, and he's found them here on the sort of new locale. Because we hoped that not everyone was sort of, you know, killed by the Empire and stuff like that. So that's kind of fun to see the two of them. And obviously he's looking to rejoin, you know, possibly recruit foundlings, build up their clan a bit.
Well, so my interpretation of this is that at the point where his story starts in this episode that we see, not a lot interesting has happened up to him.
Yes,
he's somehow
yes.
got a hold of his job and he's been searching for some level of information about where they might have, but he hasn't done anything really significant. He hasn't made contact with Grogu or Luke.
Because at this point, he still doesn't have a ship.
Yep.
We see him travelling by a sort of public bus
commercial
later on.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a little
well.
Bit hard.
Yeah. I think we'll talk about it in a bit more detail, about the encounter. The experience he has on commercial transport is clearly not suited to his lifestyle or his job, and it has significant implications for his weaponry. And I think that's why he's strongly pursuing transport of his own. I think it's super interesting, and again, this happens a little bit down the line, so we're jumping around a little bit, that he's specifically looking for a replacement for the Razor Crest, a replacement Razor Crest directly, which kind of implies that Razor Crests as a vehicle are sourceable, and we may see him have a replacement for his original Razor Crest down the line. But as I said, we're jumping around a little bit here.
One of the fun little moments, like after he's sort of gotten his bounty collected as guy at the start, he does accidentally kind of wound his leg with the Darksaber during the scuffle, which is obviously going to play into a little bit later. But one of the fun things is that when we finally hit that sort of title and sort of opening credit little segment there, instead of the Book of Boba Fett theme, it's an overlay of both the Mandalorian title theme and the Book of Boba Fett, and they work really well together. And I don't know whether that was just, you know, happy happenstance, or whether the Book of Boba Fett theme was written to work very, very well, if not overlaid with that, because that was really quite fun. Obviously, setting the tone that this is going to be very much a Din Djarin episode, very themed on him. And at this point, we don't know how much Boba Fett's going to be involved. As we got to the end, we saw that Boba Fett didn't appear in this one at all. And I didn't actually mind that. Obviously, everyone loves the Mandalorian episodes. We know we can watch a whole episode just watching him do stuff. So that was kind of fun. And it kind of, it strongly reminded me of one of the more recent seasons of Stranger Things, where they have the main storyline, and then suddenly we get this one offshoot episode where they sort of follow what Eleven is doing separate from the rest of them. And whether you have opinions on whether that episode worked or not, I feel like in this component, I think it bodes really, really well for any of the upcoming series, that we know that this precedent has been set, that these are not ring-fenced series, that we could potentially see a lot of overlap and connecting, because Star Wars fans love to pull references. Oh, you're talking about this thing that happened over here, and this character's referencing over here, and starships and stuff like that. And within The Mandalorian even, we saw lots of pulling from references, and we're seeing that again in the Book of Boba Fett. They reference all sorts of bits and pieces. We're seeing, you know, references from the prequels and original trilogy, obviously not from the sequel era, that's a little bit too far down the line, but I love the references. So this was a really fun episode because we've got a lot of that reference and tying together of little bits and pieces. So it was, I also feel like it lets them jump straight into The Mandalorian when that season 3 starts. They don't need to fully explain all of this.
Yeah, at this point we don't know if we're going to see any more of Din Djarin's personal story explored, or if they're going to leave that for The Mandalorian, and then for the final two episodes of The Book of Boba Fett, we're just going to see things centered back around the action on Tatooine. But we'll know that very, very shortly. So just to jump back and really get a little bit more structure here, I think this episode was mainly broken down into three components. Din Djarin's encounter with the Klatoonian crime lord and taking the head of that crime lord to the ring structure, the ring city, which has been confirmed as being a new location. We thought that perhaps it might relate to the wheel, the circular space station that we've seen in very old vintage expanded universe, but it's not. It is a new location. And I guess that makes sense. This seems to be on a larger scale. It doesn't have the spokes of the wheel, even though it has some overlap with the sort of theming of the wheel. Anyway, so the episode's broken into three parts. That first component, then a second component, which is his encounter with Paz Vizsla and the Armorer, and then a third component, which is his time on Tatooine. The first component we've broken down in terms of a lot of the detail, but I just want to hit on the fact that I found some aspects of it really quite artistic. Even though it was set in this sort of meatworks, sort of grungy location, there were some really cool shots where he was, and obviously the you mentioned the Darksaber not showing up instantly and not really being revealed instantly, but the actual reveal of it I thought was really, really cool. He's bending forward to use his jetpack and armor backplates to fend off blaster fire. You don't even see the hilt in his hand. You just see the ignition of the Darksaber blade as he's leaning forward and is just taking nearly the full frame. I thought it was insanely artistic and really very cool.
Yeah, there was really quite a cool scene, something to sort of really start sort of the episode off, you know, Din Djarin doing what he does best. I like the fact that they are again using alien species that are harking back to the original trilogy. We're seeing them used quite a lot in sort of the Tatooine gangs in the Book of Boba Fett. So seeing them on a completely different planet, again, in sort of a large gang format.
Yeah, we also saw them in the Sanctuary. I think it was Clatoonians that were the bad guys on Bryce Dallas Howard's previous or first Star Wars episode.
Yeah. We see reference to New Republic credits.
Yep.
Again, referencing the fact that the New Republic is sort of the government, the sort of galactic leader here, that while we do have Moff Gideon and the Imperial Remnant still floating around, they're very much seen as not really the leaders that obviously they were prior to the Death Star 2's destruction.
Yeah. Now, the main story element that comes out of this first chapter of the episode in some ways is we learn that he still has the Darksaber. That's kind of obvious, that's not a biggie, but we learn that he is using it actively, that he's relying on it. He no longer has his Amban phase pulse rifle because that was on board the Razor Crest when it was disintegrated, so he's got his Beskar spear that he wears, but he is actively using the Darksaber as a tool, as a weapon.
As we see in this scene and a little bit later on, he's not exactly the most proficient with this weapon.
For good reasons.
He's a very, you know, effective, very lethal bounty hunter. But when it comes to the Darksaber, there is obviously a learning curve with it that he has not yet mastered. Because, you know, this is a lightsaber. You know, it might look a little bit more like a sword, but it still has a lightsaber blade. And we traditionally only see them wielded by Force users that kind of have an in-sync sort of tune through the Force with their weapon, so you don't accidentally take your hand off. And
there's a historic scene in the animated series where Sabine actually remarks how light it is to her. So there is something else going on rather than just the physical properties of this device that relate to how easy it is to use, something that is perhaps, I can't think of another mechanism other than it being, you know, force imbued at some level, and you need some connection, some flow for that to really work, which really brings in up the question of how Moff Gideon was so adept at using it in his encounter with Mando using the Beskar spear back in the closing episode of The Mandalorian.
I'm sure fans will really dive into that. We still don't know the full extent as to why Moff Gideon wanted Grogu and his blood, whether he is trying to basically give himself force powers. He seemed to wield the Darksaber well, so we don't know whether he was mildly successful in that regard. Yeah. We do see the likes of Grievous wielding lightsabers without force powers, so it is possible, but there's something complicated there.
Well, because also the other aspect that tightly ties into this is that he was intimately familiar with the events on Mandalore. The destruction of Mandalore, the bombing of Mandalore. He was either directly involved with that or instigated or somehow had, you know, some relation to that, which makes us wonder what is his role, what is his deal with the Mandalorian, as in addition to what is his deal with the Force and his pursuit of Force powers. He's got a huge backstory that is going to have to be unpacked at some point.
Yeah, I think that this episode did a lot for setting up little threads, little things for fans to sort of mull over.
But they're letting it slip by without really going into a lot of detail.
I felt like when you stop and think about it, it comes out. Just jumping forward to when he is with the sort of mini two-person enclave with...
let's jump to that because, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. He goes down and, as you say, maps out a path to them using visor sensors, which show the hidden symbols in quite a cool way. And it transpires that it's just the armorer and Paz Vizsla that remain.
And they ask him how he got the Darksaber, and he said that he sort of won it by defeating Moff Gideon in battle. Paz Vizsla is like, did you kill him? And he's like, no, the New Republic took him for interrogation, because obviously he was working with, you know, New Republic people there. But Paz Vizsla sort of remarks that he should be dead for the sort of atrocities, the crimes he's committed. And the Amar references that, yeah, there's like a lot of Mandalorians that are dead because of his actions and things like that. So we don't know if Moff Gideon has a specific...
He was responsible. Vendetta against... He was responsible for the execution of the Mandalorian enclave on Navarro specifically, and I wonder if that was just him tying up loose ends from something he previously started.
Yeah.
So during that conversation with the Armorer, we do see this brief flashback to the bombing of Mandalore, which is again some superb scenery. That absolute swarm of TIE bombers was really interesting, and they're using far more heavy duty firepower than we've seen them use in a live action series to quite this extent. They also focus on the moon above the surface of the planet, which is the moon of Concordia. Concordia being a moon of the planet Mandalore. Concordia is the moon. It's the location that the hardcore old-school Mandalorians escaped to during the Mandalorian Civil War. And I find that actually quite interesting, because back when Mandalore was explored in the animated series in The Clone Wars, a lot of people were confused or didn't like the fact that they made the main population on Mandalore quite a pacifist society, which is in stark contrast to what we knew about the Mandalorian warriors of old and some of the Mandalorian culture that Karen Travis set up in her books, the Republic Commando books. But the way they sort of resolved that is that the old school warrior Mandalorians had been exiled, or in the first instance they were hiding out on the Concordia moon, and then later they were exiled permanently there so that they were separated from the main Mandalorian society. And just to tie up all the loose ends before we get back to this episode, the Children of the Watch is the name of the group that survived the Night of a Thousand Tears. The Night of a Thousand Tears is the name given to the bombing execution of all the Mandalorians on the surface. The Children of the Watch is the name given to the survivors, the old school offshoot of the Death Watch group on the Concordia moon. And the tribe, which is all we're getting the Armorer and her clan being referred to, is an offshoot or a component, a subcomponent of the Children of the Watch. So that's just a quick overview of how all those components fit together.
Which explains why they have some very strict ideas about what is a Mandalorian and how you can kind of be not a Mandalorian, because they're kind of descendant from the people that were very, very hardcore Mandalorians.
Yeah.
In that sort of small flashback that we get, well, not a flashback, but it's basically illustrating for the audience.
I'll take it,
we see the TIE bombers wreaking destruction, and then we get a scene very, very reminiscent of the opening scenes of Terminator 2, where we have Imperial droids that basically the same class as K2SO patrolling over the ground, you know, shooting at possibly, we see in shadow what appears to be sort of Mandalorian helmets on the ground. So we're not giving skull imagery, but we know that there are dead Mandalorians
so in Judgment
there.
Day in Terminator, you have skulls, you have T-800s, and you have the Hunter Killers in the sky. And now in this Star Wars version, you have Mandalorian helmets, KX series Imperial droids, and the Viper probe droids.
Yeah, the classic sort of probe droids scouting around, sort of on a higher plane, sort of looking. But yeah, it's obviously meant to really convey just how much the Empire tried to eliminate everything.
They didn't just bomb it from the sky, they scanned the surface.
They deployed a lot of droids to make sure and go along, because we see them shooting at things on the ground. You know, I guess it's supposed to infer that might be a body, and they're just shooting it again to make sure that the person's dead. So yeah, obviously this is a huge sort of impact for the audience. We really get why the Mandalorians have kind of got this, you know, really troubled history. And it's in these moments that between conversation between the Armorer and Din Djarin, we get a lot of important information about Mandalorian history and culture. She talks about the fact that the Empire was there for 30 years, but Mandalorians have existed for 10,000 years. And sort of, you know, obviously she sees Mandalorians as far superior, even though the fact that the Empire did wreak a lot of havoc on their culture. And then, of course, we reiterate what we kind of know from the end of The Mandalorian, that the Darksaber must be won by creed in battle. It can't be gifted. And it's cursed if you don't win it in a sort of an honorable in-battle way.
And it's at that point where that the Armorer reveals her distaste for Bo-Katan and her possession of the Darksaber. And she actually seems to blame Bo-Katan for the downfall of Mandalore, because she believes that she invoked the curse by holding the saber and claiming
That there
claiming
was a...
leadership.
sort of like a foretelling that there would be somebody that would basically dishonor the Darksaber by taking it dishonorably, and that the Mandalorians would be scattered to the four winds, which we now know is what has happened, that whatever Mandalorians are still alive are kind of been scattered across the universe trying to hide. And she's bitter, she's angry.
I think it's super interesting that this is Bryce Dallas Howard's episode, because it deals with both these subcultures within the Mandalorian superculture. Just as a side note, there was a really fun interaction on social media between Katie Sackhoff, who plays Bo-Katan, and Emily Swallow, who plays the Armorer. Bouncing off each other on social media, which almost makes me wonder that they know each other from an encounter on set.
Oh, I need to see that. I really do hope that these conversations are really setting up that we're going to be diving a lot more into Mandalorian.
We're not going to see that until season 3 of Mandalorian. It's not going to crop up.
That means, like, we saw him being bounty hunter. We got a bit of the Empire, and I think we're going to see much more Mandalorian-ness in season 3, because they're putting a lot of sort of exposition and history into this episode, so that it's not getting bogged down at the start of the Mandalorian season 3. They're just going to jump into it because they're like, okay, everyone knows what's going on. And so she basically says that only those who walk the way escape to the curse / purge. So basically the ones that are the true Mandalorians, the ones who are pure of faith, the ones that keep their helmets on.
But she's also referring to, that's the philosophical explanation for their escape, but the practical explanation for their escape is that group, the followers of the way, are the ones that were on the moon when the main planet was bombed, and hence the reference that I just discussed to the tribe and the Children of the Watch.
And another little possibly foreboding is she obviously catches sight of the fact that the Mandalorian has a Beskar spear, asks him where he got it from, and she's like, no, that thing can't exist because a Beskar spear can pierce Beskar armor. And I'm like, okay, that's important. So she immediately wants to start melting it down, and he's like, yeah, sure, whatever. And they agree to make some armor out of it. And through a little segment, we know that she makes a piece of armor for Grogu. We don't know what it is. We don't see it. She bundles it up in a little piece of cloth.
Seems to be chainmail, and that's why it can be bundled up into such a small little package.
I kind of hope that it's like a little shoulder pauldron with a tiny little Mudhorn clan symbol or something like that. Because we don't know where the rings that sort of attach it to fabric, because he clearly doesn't have a whole suit of armor to attach a piece to. I wasn't sure if that was a little bit of a misdirection.
Well, there's going to be some component of chainmail, but whether or not that's the whole thing. It's one way or another, it bundles into pretty small packets, but then again, it doesn't need to be quite big. And the other main talking point is that the bundle that she ties it up with clearly looks like a version of Grogu with the ears poking out the side, and that's far from accidental and well executed.
The armor also makes the comment that the Darksaber is a much more sort of honorable weapon for him to wield instead of the Beskar spear. And
I found that particularly interesting because it kind of conveyed that she has no ambition to have it for herself, even though she looks very cool when she's wielding it, when she's inspecting it earlier on.
Yes.
She seems to be quite happy. She seems to think at that point, maybe not so much later, that he is worthy of it.
Well, especially because if it's this sort of legendary leadership sort of icon for Mandalorian culture, you kind of want it to be somebody in your own little private group. She obviously doesn't want Bo-Katan to have it. So if anybody's got to have it, she wants it to be
there's not many choices at
this point. Yeah. So she's like, yep, Din can have it so long as one of those other sort of disbelievers, the people that take their helmets off, so long as they don't have it.
I don't know what
she's happy
long
for
game
Din.
Is. Her and Paz Vizsla, I think Paz Vizsla is the one that says, and now we are three when Din Djarin turns up. But they, and Amara said something along the lines of, we'll put you to work soon.
Yeah.
They must have some sort of plan, but I don't know what it is to expand from two to
I don't know whether that just means
a number of many.
Because back in the original Mandalorian series, he was basically the one that was allowed to leave and go basically earn money by bounty hunting while everyone was kept sort of basically hidden in secret down below. So I don't know whether that means that they'll basically put him to work earning money so that they can build up by Beskar, foundlings.
If they know of others out there that they need to find and or advertise to, basically. That's
Whether they need to buy a ship,
they
get some
symbols in the understructure of the other
Mandalorians would be able to find them.
There must be others out there that they're familiar with, and they're going to try and recruit, or at least get together.
Mm. So after we see a sort of a sparring segment between the armorer, and she uses her tools. We still haven't seen her wield a full weapon, but she's got her sort of forge tools that are obviously made of Beskar, because she's using them to spar against Din Djarin wielding the darksaber. And it seems to be, he mentions that it's getting heavier every time he sort of tries to wield it. And she's talking about, you're fighting against it, you know, you've got to be fighting your opponent, not the blade, because he's almost dragging it, trying to get it up. It seems to be very, very heavy, which is a thing that we haven't really seen as a problem encountered before with the darksaber.
Yeah, because Moff Gideon, as we say, wielded it effortlessly, as did Sabine and the Rebels. And it's certainly curious, because I don't know what the practical explanation for that is. It's an energy weapon. The hilt,
I don't know whether kind of like the force sort of fights against him if you're not like true of heart or
because it has no mass. The hilt is made of Beskar, but the energy blade doesn't have mass.
And we know that he's very, very proficient with fighting. He mentions that he uses the Beskar spear to defeat Moff Gideon. So we know he's good with sort of melee weapons. So that's going to come up again. We'll get some more explanation whether he will sort of overcome that, or whether the darksaber will ultimately end with somebody else, because it might have sort of a will of the force, and it's like going to sort of rebel if it's being wielded by somebody that it doesn't want to. Who knows?
That's the essence of that component of the story. But then we jump to the fact that Paz Vizsla has been ruminating, and he comes to the conclusion that he can win, he should win, he's entitled to win the darksaber back and claim leadership. And he partly believes this because it was his ancestor, Tar Vizsla, that actually
created
the founder of the House of Vizsla, who made the darksaber. And Tar Vizsla was a
Mandalorian
and a Jedi. But he thinks he's worthy.
Because we see Pre Vizsla in the animated series wielding it. So we know that there is a certain lineage that believes that because they made it, it's sort of like a royal line that they should be the one to lead. And he obviously sees it as, okay, Din Djarin's not knowing how to use this thing. I deserve it because it's my family lineage and challenges to a duel.
Yeah. The duel's fairly short-lived because the saber is hard to wield.
Mm.
And ultimately, even though there's a little bit of jeopardy, ultimately Din Djarin has the upper hand by using a vibro sword and getting it to Paz Vizsla's throat.
Yeah.
And the armorer intervenes. And then we get this really interesting scene where I don't know quite why it happened at this point, but I guess it kind of makes sense in terms of tradition related to duels and
you sort of have to confirm your honor or something like that.
So she asks Paz Vizsla first, is your helmet ever been taken off? Yada yada. This is the way. She asks Din Djarin the same question.
You
removed your helmet, or has somebody else removed your helmet?
I love the pause, because you know his face must be scrambling. Like she's like, you must answer with honor by creed, and he's just like, I can't lie. You know, the audience all knows he's taken it off at least twice.
It didn't just fall off.
Yeah, and he's obviously like, no, I don't want to get in trouble, but he has to be honest that he did take it off. And they're like, you're not a Mandalorian anymore.
Significant turning point here, because he's wanted to be a Mandalorian. He has a foundling to the Mandalorian culture, and he's wanted to embrace it. For a brief moment there, it looks like he may try and seek redemption, but there's not a clear path to that. So he's basically exiled and separated from that aspect of Mandalorian culture. Significant on many, many levels. Significant for the Mandalorian, also sort of significant for, well, both this hidden remnant of the Mandalorian culture, but also really tying into where we could be going with the two different approaches to Mandalorian culture and what path Din Djarin's ultimately going to take and where his allegiances will ultimately lie. So real turning point in the story.
Yeah. Din Djarin asks, you know, how can he redeem himself? And the armorer replies that I didn't catch the exact wording, but it's basically he needs to like be in the waters in the mines on Mandalore. And he's like, well, Mandalore's been bombed. So she's just like, well, so obviously he's got somewhat of a side quest here, that if he wants to sort of reclaim his Mandalorian honor, he's going to have to find his way to Mandalore, find a mine. And basically, I guess it's some sort of symbolic baptism. He needs to be sort of, you know, reborn into the Mandalorian culture, sort of wash away his sin of taking his helmet off, which may or may not happen in season three, or whether he will go in a completely different direction.
We missed another key point. There's a couple of references to the mythosaur and the fact that it doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
Almost. It's probably a bit of a stretch, a bit of a long shot, almost kind of implied that there might be a Hunt for the Mythosaur type thing somewhere down the line. It says maybe that's a path to redemption or unification of the Mandalorian.
Yeah, that there's another sort of legend that one will ride the Mythosaur again and unite the clans or something.
Maybe.
Because, yes, she did.
It didn't feel accidental.
Yeah, when she was getting tools out of her chest when she was going to melt the thing down, she referenced it, and I was like, they keep doing this. It's kind of subtle, kind of just a little bit of an offhand one, but they do reference it, and I think fans would love that.
Okay, so Din Djarin's exiled from the Mandalorian culture and physical location at this point, so he's heading off to Tatooine, which we later find out is in response to a message that he's got from Palimoto on Tatooine. He has to take a commercial transport to get to Tatooine. Interesting that these are the same transports that we saw in previous episodes of The Book of Boba Fett, which I've mentioned that I find quite a cool concept and quite a cool design. To get on board the commercial transport, he has to relinquish all of his weaponry into basically checked luggage, which makes everybody nervous that he's actually going to get it all back intact. But I think this is a significant story point for a couple of reasons. I think it really emphasizes that commercial transport, not having a ship, just ain't working for him.
He mentions that he doesn't want to give up his weapons because weapons are part of my religion. And the droid's like, well, nah, you can't do it otherwise. And I was really nervous because we see him pull out the Darksaber hilt and kind of consider it for a bit. And he's like, well, yeah, this is a weapon. I kind of have to put it in the box. And kind of threatens the droid saying, I know everything that's in there. He even takes out all his little whistling birds out of his gauntlet, you know, like every little thing.
The cable from his wrist launcher, yeah.
Yeah, so clearly he doesn't like parting with his weapons, that this is, yeah, not a way that a bounty hunter should be conducting business in that. So obviously he's very keen, goes to Palimoto, and this is a really fun segment. Very dialogue heavy. No. We got through a lot of the dialogue with the armorer.
It opens before the Mandalorian, before Din Djarin arrives. It opens with the revelation of a BD droid.
Yes.
And a Womp Rat pursuing the droids and Palimoto fighting them off. And this is quite a cool interaction here. The BD droid was a surprise. Looks insanely cool, and I think everyone fell in love with it pretty quickly. They fell in love with its antics and its personality.
Yes. This is the same droid that was first sort of designed and appeared in the Jedi Fallen Order game. It's a companion to Cal Kestis as you play through the story. So it's an incredibly cute one, and I really want to see merchandise of this. I think everyone in our house was like, we want one. We want one of these things running around. And it was really fun. And amongst all the other droids, we see Treadwell, we see the Pit droids, we've got Astromex there. So that's kind of fun. And just when the Womp Rat grabs Palimoto, that's when Mando comes in, shoots it, and then they have the conversation that he is there for a replacement ship.
Yeah, and as we mentioned before, he thinks she describes it as a replacement for the Razor Crest. He interpreted it as a replacement Razor Crest. I think that's significant and may foreshadow a return to him actually having a Razor Crest down the line. But in this short term, he's got a different vehicle which has different capabilities, different functionality, and that's probably going to play into the story over the next couple of episodes in a fun and interesting way. So quite a bit of montage, minimal exposition dialogue, just sort of filler to get this interesting, going to blow your mind starship back up and running. And I think that sentence, it's going to blow your mind, was meant for both the audience as well as for Din Djarin.
Yeah, there were some fun moments in this one. She's trying to sell the idea to Din because he's like, this is way smaller than I was thinking. Well,
we haven't actually mentioned what it is. Everyone saw it, so we know we're talking about an N1, yeah. Number N1 starfighter here, which is a really cool callback to the prequels.
Yeah, she specifically mentions that they were commissioned by the Queen of Naboo, which is obviously a really fun callback. Obviously, they're on Tatooine. You know, there are elements of Phantom Menace here, so it was really fun. And obviously, they're going to make this. We see that they are good fighters. We see them, you know, in battle in episode one. Yeah. You know, Anakin pilots it, so we get some sort of really fun things. And I said before that they don't really reference the sequels. There was one little reference here where she says that it'll be with custom mods, it'll be faster than a Fathier, which we see as the racing animals from The Last Jedi. So I just, obviously they can't reference things like First Order and stuff like that, but creatures and things like that. I thought that that was a fun little note because we get a few little creatures in this. We had the Womprat. She refers to a little nest of scurriers, these kind of little kind of desert mouse type little creatures that we see
originally showed up in the special editions around Mos Eisley.
But they're very cute. We see BD kind of scoping them out and sort of watching them scurry around during this montage scene. And obviously she's trying to convince Mando that this is a good ship. So we get this kind of building montage. Yep. We get a little bit of that sort of dad moment where Din Djarin is asking BD to point his little eye torch where he needs to work. It's sort of very referencing, you know, the father son working on the car engine together and pointing the light where you need to see it. I thought that that was cute.
There's a little bit of Palimotto backstory going on just as an overlay to all of this. She talks about having never left the planet. She talks about having had a relationship with Jawa
because she knows how to speak Jawa, which I think is quite fun.
She has a ongoing relationship with the Jawas in general to get parts and to give them unwanted parts from her junk bin.
Yeah, it's basically implied that she asked the Jawas for what she needs and they basically go steal it. Mando wants something specific to kind of soup up the engine and the Jawas come back with it and he asks where they got it and they basically got underneath a Pike Spice Runner vehicle and basically stole this part. And the fun element here is that the part that they have stolen for him is essentially what Han, Luke, and Leia try to wedge in the trash compactor. It's like a long stick that looks like it's got giant bubble wrap wrapped around in a few places, and he seems quite impressed with this, and I was just sitting there going, that's the stick from the trash compactor. So that was a fun little moment. Like, now we know what that thing was and what it's supposed to do.
It's also, I mean, I guess we did know, we have seen the Jawas trying to steal stuff
because they pulled everything off his ship when he parked it.
In the first season,
they stripped his ship. So they steal stuff if they just find it. They stole the armor off Boba Fett. Yeah. And
Even in the original trilogy, they showed distinct interest in Luke's land speeder, even though they didn't get to taking parts off it when they arrived at Mos Eisley. So it's clear that they've been referred to as scavengers, but they're not scavengers necessarily just of found parts. Well, I guess they are all found parts in a way. But
yes, they find them on other people's things. Yeah, so I thought that that was fun. And then, of course, we get the big reveal that they've kind of finished their modifications. It's almost all silver. It's got sort of like a big raised engine in the front. It's got far bigger, obvious guns out the front.
You just mentioned the colour there. I don't think they really played on this much, and it may not be significant, but I thought it was kind of interesting that it was just plain silver because it was... And there was some just leftover stripes of the yellowy-orange colouring, which actually harks back to his colour palette, his aesthetic for his Razor Crest, which was all silver, just with some singular yellow-orange markings on it. So I don't know if that was... I guess in part that was partly necessary just before the reconstruction of the N1, but it does match his aesthetic.
Silver is very much his colour. We know that from the likes of the Armourer and Paz Vizsla, they've got blues, they've got oranges and reds, so they've got all sorts of colours, but he keeps his Beskar very silver Beskar, I think it matched really well.
I don't think that was accidental because we see them putting new armour plates on the N1 superstructure, but we also see him using a grinder to take paint off it, so it wasn't just leaving it. He was actually making, you know, visual aesthetic modifications to it as well.
Even though at this point he hasn't actually said that he wants to buy it, but he's still clearly tweaking he's getting the idea. He knows that this could be useful. And then, of course, it's all done. And Pally says, no one's catching you in this thing. And that she has taken out the astromech port. And it has a clear dome on it, akin to the sort of the front pilot one. And it looks like Grogu would be able to fit in that because she says, you know, with your disposition, I figured you wouldn't want a droid. And he's definitely a lot more friendly with the droids, especially with BD. He sort of thanks him for helping him figure out where a piece of plating goes.
So he's not
being mean, because originally he said no droids were going to work on his ship, and clearly they're working with a huge cohort of droids to refurb this one. But I still don't think he's up to the point of owning a droid or having a droid companion. But then, of course, we get him turning it on using the classic buttons that we see Anakin using in the cockpit from Phantom Menace. Yeah. And and starts it up, lifts up. We get, it's a really fun blend of kind of the classic N1 sound mixed with pod racers, because we know pod racers are very, very fast, souped up engines, kind of customized. We certainly see Anakin's ones that are sort of built from parts and modded from the ground up. So I love that sort of blend of noise. And of course, we get him testing it out. And this is where we really lean heavily into some of the episode 1 moments, because he basically, his test run, as Pelly kind of directs him, is basically the exact pod race track that we see. We see the very tall sort of rock structures. We see the canyon. We see the ramp that Anakin sort of hit at one point. We see, she refers to Biggers Canyon, yeah. And we indeed even see a Womp Rat in a Biggers Canyon in this section, obviously referencing where Luke Skywalker would have gone flying his T-16 back in the day. And then, of course, he takes off into the clouds to really see what it's like up in space. And he gets in trouble for flying too close to the freighter, that he took to Tatooine, is now heading off somewhere else, and he's kind of zooming around it, and we get some really cool montages. But then we get two New Republic X-Wings kind of basically pulling up as cops, you know, telling him off for speeding and flying too close to the one. This was interesting because the two pilots of the X-Wings...
We have seen them both before.
We have seen them both, yes.
But not as the same... Well, one of them is the same character, an existing character, and one is a different character. So the lieutenant that first speaks to Din Djarin, the one that's first revealed, played by Max Lloyd-Jones, who was the actor, who was the body double for Luke Skywalker's appearance in the closing episode of The Mandalorian.
So this is fun. So while his face and voice weren't truly seen, he did perform as Luke, but obviously it's been mapped over with Mark Hamill's likeness and voice, but they've given him a character.
He's got a similar facial structure to Mark Hamill, that's how they used him in that role.
And so it's really fun to see him in an X-Wing.
I think that's why he's got facial hair.
Yes,
in this episode, just to make him look like a more of a distinct character.
Yeah, but they give him a fair bit of dialogue here. I mean, he gets to fly an X-Wing, you know, classic sort of X-Wing get up and that. And while he's kind of referring to, you know, we want to sort of check out your ID and your registration and stuff like that, like if you got pulled over by a cop. And the other pilot that turns out to be Captain Teeva that we have seen before kind of recognizes Din Djarin's voice and asks him a few questions, like, didn't you fly a Razorcrest? Well, you know, there was like a scuffle with the Imperial Remnant. And before sort of, you know, he can sort of get too many answers out of Din Djarin, we see him use sort of the sublight boost that Pelly referenced earlier in the episode, and he just takes off. And they're like, whoa, that was like, I didn't even see him jump to hyperspace. And they're like, no, that wasn't hyperspace, that was a sublight engines. So they are sort of like flabbergasted that this ship is so fast. So that's definitely setting up something for a future episode, or if he's still flying this thing in the Mandalorian series, we know it's very, very fast. We have not seen the firepower in this, but yes, it's certainly a good souped up ship that I think matches with the Mandalorian
just in terms of setting things up for future episodes, talking about this ship, talking about potential for another Razorcrest, I hope and believe that this isn't the last we've seen of Pelly Motto, that she's going to return in a subsequent episode of The Mandalorian as well.
In some ways, I feel like because we're not going to have as much Cara Dune in some of the upcoming series, that they're building up some more interesting female characters. Certainly, he seems to be okay with, you know, technical components, looking after his ships and stuff like that. But if you're flying around all the time, like, you know, when he lands originally, he still needs some help, you know, he still needs parts and things like that.
He wants to stay off the grid. Yeah. They do make reference to the fact that this ship isn't able to be monitored by the current Empire.
Yeah, she says it's pre-Empire, so off the grid. So
it's registration and so forth, and transponders or whatever aren't able to be picked up by Imperial tech at this point.
So I think she's a really fun character, and I really hope we get merchandise, we see her more, whether she just kind of has these episodic interactions with the main characters like Boba.
Make a 5-pack or a 4-pack that in the Black Series that has her and the droids.
Droids, that would go down so well. And then obviously when he, one little moment when he lands back down and she asks him how it was, he says wizard, which is obviously a reference to Anakin. But I like the fact that they're kind of cementing that as just an expression in the Star Wars universe,
Or maybe even specifically the Tatooine slang, Tatooine Ringo, because it was Owen that referred to Ben as a crazy old wizard.
Yeah. So I thought that was fun. And then we find out, because she basically sort of breaks in and introduces herself, Fennec is there. And this is where we finally join up with the Book of Boba Fett. And she talks to Din Djarin and is like, this isn't a bounty hunter job. We need some muscle. And sort of flings him some credits. And he kind of considers it and flings them back to Fennec and says, it's on the house. So we know, yep, he's going to work with them. He obviously honors and trusts Boba Fett because Boba Fett helped him rescue Grogu when the Empire got him and said, it's on the house. He just needs to pay a visit to a little friend first. And that's where it leaves off. And we're okay.
That's where it leaves off. Frustratingly, that's where it leaves off, because is that so much happened in this episode and it was so engaging that at that point in the story, I think, well, things are just warming up. We've got a few more scenes to unpack yet, but it wasn't even a short episode.
A lot just
happened, and you just were so glued to everything that was happening that you didn't really notice the passage of time, and it felt like there was more to come, but a fairly long episode wrapped up at that point.
So I feel like the way that I'm sort of guessing, the way that it feels like they might run, that we won't see his little trip to visit
we don't have time for that
Grogu, no. That the next time we're going to see him back helping Boba Fett, and then the scene where the little interlude is going to be covered in the first chunk of the Mandalorian season 3. So that's another big tease about what we can expect in that first season. And oh my gosh, this is just really making me super excited for more Star Wars live action in the Mandalorian in particular.
All right, lots of exciting things to talk about this week, but we'll dig into things as they unpack next week. For now, that's about it for this installment. I guess we are done doing talking. If you've got any thoughts on the topics we discussed today, including that episode of The Book of Boba Fett, we're definitely keen to hear them. Leave a comment on the YouTube page or our website page for this podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you taking your time to listen to us share our passion for Star Wars. Stay tuned to our website, swnz.co.nz, for Star Wars news for New Zealanders and another podcast episode next week. Don't forget, you can jump on over to either our Facebook group or the SWNZ message boards to discuss all the latest Star Wars news with other Kiwi fans. Kia ora, kia noho haumaru, thank you for listening and stay safe.
Tūro Hawaiki, may the Force be with you.